Kyiv attacked in a massive onslaught of missiles and drones.
Two drones were really, really close, and it was, you know, a feeling that it was the sound that if they almost are getting through the window to your apartment.
Plus, a look at the ideology of American and European right-wing views toward Ukraine.
In part, I think there is a generational shift that has occurred, and you see that among members of Congress. Older ones still have the muscle memory of the Cold War days, where the younger ones see U.S. foreign policy increasingly through the prism of Iraq and Afghanistan.
And later in the program, how have farmers in the United States been affected by the war in Ukraine, thousands of kilometers away? Today is Monday, May 29th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Russia launched one of its biggest assaults on Kyiv since the war began, including a rare daytime attack Monday morning. The attacks started Saturday night as the city of Kyiv was preparing to celebrate the anniversary of its founding over 1,500 years ago. Lucy Fielder of Reuters has more.
Russia unleashed waves of airstrikes on the Ukrainian capital overnight as it prepared to celebrate the anniversary of its founding, Kyiv Day, on Sunday. Officials called it a record drone attack on the city, the largest since the war started. Ukraine's Air Force said it downed 52 out of the 54 Iranian-made kamikaze drones. Falling debris killed a 41-year-old man, Kyiv Mayor Vitaly Klitschko said, and set a three-story warehouse on fire. Reuters witnesses said air raid alerts started soon after midnight, and some people stood on their balconies screaming insults at Russian President Vladimir Putin. With the Ukrainian counteroffensive looming 15 months into the war, Moscow has intensified airstrikes after a lull of nearly 2 months, chiefly targeting military sites and supplies. Kyiv Day marks the official founding of the city 1,541 years ago. Usually it holds street fairs, live concerts and special exhibitions, but this year's celebrations were planned on a smaller scale.
Reuters' Lucy Fielder reporting for us today. What's the attitude in Kyiv after the attacks? It seems that largely the attitude is one of defiance. VOA's Miroslava Gungadze reports.
On the night of May 28, Kyiv became the target of an unprecedented two-wave air attack unleashed by Russia. The attack came on Kyiv Day, celebrated on the last Sunday of May every year to mark the city's founding 1,541 years ago. Typically, this day is filled with street fairs, live concerts, special museum exhibitions, and sporting events. The Ukrainian military, equipped with improved Western-supplied air defense systems, successfully intercepted and destroyed at least 40 drones. However, falling debris claimed the life of 41-year-old man and injured 35-year-old woman, according to the city mayor. This was the 14th airstrike by Russian on Kyiv in single months. Several districts, including the historic Pechersk neighborhood, bore the brunt of the overnight assault. Despite the airstrike, Ukrainians keep their spirit up with unbroken resilience and determination to stand firm in the face of Russian aggression.
For me, it's like usual things of our life. It's like tomorrow they send, yesterday we'll send, today we'll send the drones. It's like the usual, like a morning coffee and night drone attacks. It's our life.
Actually, today in the morning, after that sleepless night, one more sleepless night, I was thinking that our tiredness is nothing in comparison with the guys who protect us on the line of front. So I think we don't have any right to cry or to give up, because if we will give up, then what is the reason for our defenders to stay there? I think we should be strong in order to support them.
You know, I'm celebrating life and Kyiv birthday too, because tomorrow was a terrible night, so we have to split our blood and calm down.
Well, apparently there was a drone attack last night. I blissfully slept through it, and this morning I'm going for a run. I'm not going to give Putin and the Russians the satisfaction of disrupting my life.
Miroslava Gungadze, VOA News, Kyiv, Ukraine.
During this past weekend's attacks in Kyiv, VOA's Miroslava Gungadze spoke with former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, John Edward Herbst, inside a Kyiv bomb shelter during the attacks.
Ensure a victory for Ukraine, and for that matter, a victory for American interests. But in the absence of such staunch leadership, what we see is some of our allies are pushing the alliance in the right direction, pushing our partners in the right direction. You know, finally, Germany and the United States in late January, early February, decided to send the tanks Ukraine needs. That was only because the Brits, the Poles, the Baltic states insisted on sending tanks, and the U.S. and the Germany became embarrassed. We see the same dynamic with the supply of F-16s. And here you have to really credit Zelensky with his trip to Europe 10 or 14 days ago, where he helped build the F-16 coalition. And finally, the administration said, okay, they were embarrassed by, again, the Brits, in that case also, I think it was the Dutch and some others who said, we want to send F-16s to Ukraine. And this it's unfortunate that it's not Washington being the clear leader. But, you know, in the absence of that, in the wake of the timidity of senior Biden administration officials, the Brits step up, and thank God for that British stiff upper lip.
So what's up with administration?
Look, again, the policy they are conducting has been adequate to the challenge, right? The Russians are not winning. They're actually kind of losing. But they have been spooked by Putin's nuclear threats. Now, obviously, any time a nuclear power talks about using nuclear weapons, the United States has to pay close attention. But paying close attention is not the same thing as self-deterring, because we think that this is a red line or that is a Putin red line. It would, in fact, be disastrous for Putin to use nukes. And there are some Russian former officials who are well within the bubble of Kremlin approval who've said this publicly. But these constant Putin threats have clearly spooked senior people in the Biden administration. Not completely. Obviously, we're providing a great deal of support. But they say, no, we can't do X because Putin says he may escalate, or we can't do Y because they may use nuclear weapons. We eventually come around to doing X or sending Y, but much more slowly than we should.
That was former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, John Edward Herbst, speaking with VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief, Miroslava Gungadze. The interview was conducted in a bomb shelter in Kyiv during the recent attacks. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. We'll find out how Kyiv is recovering and starting a new week after a weekend of terrifying attacks. Anna Chernikova is our reporter in Kyiv.
Yeah, it was an extremely difficult and extremely emotional weekend for the whole Ukraine, but particularly for Kyiv. And probably it's worth mentioning that yesterday on Sunday it was a Kyiv day. So every last Sunday of May, Kyiv celebrates its birthday. And it was 1,541st birthday of Kyiv. And Russian military made a huge present for the residents and for the city, if we can call it this way, because during the night from Saturday to Sunday, it was the most massive drone attack on Kyiv since the beginning of full-scale invasion back in February. So there were 58 drones targeting Ukraine, and over 40 drones were targeted Kyiv particularly.
What did it sound like to be in Kyiv during all that?
So during the night, it was extremely loud. There were a lot of drones, and those drones were coming. And basically how it works is that they come in a group, and then this group of drones, they just split, and separate drones go to different directions. So it was really, really loud because the air defense was working very actively, and particularly in my neighborhood next to my apartment building, there were also quite a lot of drones. And two of the drones, I never heard the drones that close before and that loud before. Two drones were really, really close. It was, you know, a feeling that it was the sound that if they almost are getting through the window to your apartment. So it was really some, you know, some vibrations and the mirrors inside of the building, the glass inside of the inside of the apartment was shaking. So it was really something, something quite intense. And it lasted for around 5 hours, so most of Kyiv citizens spent this night in the shelters, either in the metro station or in the parking lot, so depending on in the basements, depending on the options people had.
So, mm-hmm. Anna, that was over the weekend. I understand there were also attacks during the day on Monday. Can you tell us what happened there? And tell us, that's unusual, isn't it?
So tonight was another attack, and it was combined attack of missiles and drones. So again, people didn't sleep over the night. However, this attack was shorter than previous night, but not much. And well, it stopped at 5 o'clock in the morning. So people went to sleep at around 5 o'clock in the morning. And then around noon, another air raid siren was on. But then in around 5 minutes, it was a huge, powerful explosion. Again, people ran to the shelter, and you even can find some footage of children running to the shelter from the streets because, as I said, it was really unexpected that another attack would happen just 6 hours after the night attack.
Now, Anna, you mentioned that people were getting to fall asleep at around 5 a.m. because they'd been up in the shelters all night. How are people in Kyiv feeling? I would imagine the whole city is very sleepy and I would say probably a little angry over what's been happening.
You know, people angry for sure, people stressed for sure. But I should say that a lot of people, and I think this is probably 90% of Kyiv citizens particularly, they are not giving up, and they just have some coffee and they continue their, you know, jobs, they continue their life. And a lot of people, they say that, well, we're not allowed to be upset or angry or to cry or to give up because Ukrainian defenders are defending us at the front line, and it's much more difficult for them to defend us there. So we should be strong. And I think that this is the main message around Ukraine in general, and particularly for Kyiv citizens these days, that they have to be strong in order to win.
We certainly hope you stay safe. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
Former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's recent visit to a Republican event in Texas highlights the differences between American and European right-wing attitudes towards Ukraine. I'm joined by Dalibor Roak, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
Boris Johnson visited Texas on Monday. He was speaking to a group of Republican donors and opinion makers in Dallas, an event organized by the D.C.-based think tank Center for European Policy Analysis. And I think the intention behind the event was for SEPA to bring in Boris Johnson, who is a popular figure in conservative circles, to help make the case for continued U.S. support to Ukraine, to a increasingly Ukraine-weary Republican crowd.
Well, how did that go? It seems that especially on the far right of the Republican Party here in the States, support for Ukraine is decreasing. How was his message received?
It is true that opinion in the United States has grown increasingly weary of the U.S. support to Ukraine, more so on the Republican side than on the Democratic side. And it is also true that this is associated in the United States, at least, with a certain transformation of what was traditionally conservative Republican Party to a much more populist, nationalist entity organized around, you know, ideas of America first, around much greater sense of sort of foreign policy realism, and so on and so forth. And much of that is modeled after the example of European populist parties, from French Marine Le Pen-led Rassemblement National to Viktor Orban's Fidesz party in Hungary. And what is quite interesting is that in Europe, there isn't really a one-on-one mapping between populist parties and skepticism towards Ukraine. It really is just a matter of few sort of outliers who are adamantly opposed to helping Ukraine, but by and large, the sort of right-wing populist scene in Europe is quite attuned to the need of defending Ukraine against Russian aggression.
And why do you think there is that difference across the Atlantic?
Well, so one European actor really stands out in the field, and that's Viktor Orban, who has invested heavily into deepening of his ties to the Republican Party, partly through hosting the CPAC conference in Budapest, partly through various forms of outreach in Washington and beyond, partly thanks through his messaging on culture war issues that are salient in the United States. And so he has become, I think, in sort of Republican imagination, a kind of avatar for continental nationalism or populism, if you will. And many in the Republican Party would like to model Republican politics going forward after the Hungarian example. However, if you look beyond Hungary, you'll see many other politicians who are not sort of haven't arisen in sort of Republican imaginations to the same level of prominence, who take a very different approach. The Polish government, which was very often compared to the Orban government in Hungary, has been among the leaders in the European assistance to Ukraine. The Italian government, in a country which traditionally has been quite dovish on Russia, we've seen a very clear line trying to help Ukraine.
So let's get back to the American Republican Party, if we can.
Sure.
I believe that if you said to somebody just a few years ago, hey, there's this country in Europe and Russia is invading them, they need our help, or else this Russian ideology, this Russian menace can spread, we should help them. Following after you know, the Ronald Reagan model, I think a lot of Republicans would have said yes. Now we tend to see that shifting into, as you said, the America First model. What explains that shift in ideology?
In part, I think there is a generational shift that has occurred, and you see that among members of Congress. Older ones still have the muscle memory of the Cold War days, where the younger ones see U.S. foreign policy increasingly through the prism of Iraq and Afghanistan, and therefore the Trumpian message that we shouldn't really be involved around the world and we should always judge our engagement overseas through the very narrow prism of what's in it for us, I think that does resonate in certain segments of the electorate. And it makes it all the more important for responsible leaders to actually make the case for America's internationalism and for why, over the long term and in a sort of broader picture, it is in the U.S. interest that Russia be soundly defeated in Ukraine, that it positions us much better for our long-term competition with China, for example, and that it amplifies our influence around the world if we do stand on Ukraine's side and provide Ukraine with what it needs to finish the job. Alas, not very many people on the Republican right are doing that.
That was Dalibor Rohak, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. You can check out his article on the AEI webpage or in the New York Post. For a second year, the war in Ukraine is adding to worries for American farmers already pinched by higher interest rates. VOA's Kane Farbaugh speaks with farmers in the Midwest state of Illinois about the impact of world events as they launch another planting season amid cascading uncertainties.
Last year's start of the war in Ukraine brought chaos for farmers like David Iserman.
It just totally disrupted the whole system. Prices went up in anticipation.
The biggest price hikes were for a farmer's inputs, like fertilizer.
The problem is that Russia and their ally Belarus are major suppliers of the three things we use, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. So that disrupted our supply of that. When you take out two of the world's major suppliers, it affects things.
As the war in Ukraine grinds on for a second year, Iserman is planning for a new growing season. He is thankful that, for now, supply chain bottlenecks have eased.
Things have kind of worked themselves out a little bit. Prices are dropping. Grain prices are down from last year, so people are not as aggressive, I think, on their fertilizer purchases, which is helping a little bit.
Lately, we've also seen prices sliding.
Joe Camp of Comstock Investments, an agriculture risk management firm, says the overall price for grains like corn, soybeans, and wheat stabilized after Russia and Ukraine agreed to a grain selling accord brokered by the United Nations and Turkey in 2022.
Since then, we've not seen a material increase in demand, but we know that that can change going forward.
Particularly if the grain deal, which was extended May 17th for 2 months, falls apart as the war rages on.
It's been something that's actually taken prices lower as we compete with cheap wheat, continue to do that. Same thing with corn. And it keeps prices, I think, generally lower than they otherwise would be if we had that demand flowing back from Russia and Ukraine.
The Black Sea Grain Initiative also impacts a farmer's input prices.
Even the grain export deal allows for Russia to continue sending out fertilizer. So relative to what we feared, we're well-stocked and benefiting from at least lower prices heading into the new season.
But while Iserman is shelling out less money to plant and grow crops, the cost of financing those purchases has risen due to soaring interest rates.
Yeah, it affects everybody we touch.
A tight U.S. labor market has made it harder for Iserman to hire farmhands and other workers.
You try to find somebody to haul grain for you. You know, if you don't have your own truck, it's very difficult. That problem is there. We just don't have the people to drive the trucks anymore.
While Iserman is slowly incorporating automation into his farming operation,
it doesn't have automatic turn.
He has no choice but to depend on himself and his family to plant and harvest the crops he grows this year. Kane Farbaugh, VOA News, Streeter, Illinois.
Russia has issued an arrest warrant for U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham. As the Associated Press's Rita Foley explains, he was shown in a video edited to make it appear that he said money spent to kill Russians was the best money the United States has ever spent.
Russia wants to arrest Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina after what he said about the war in Ukraine. Graham met with Ukraine's President Zelensky on Friday. Zelensky's office later released an edited video in which Senator Graham says the Russians are dying and describes U.S. military assistance to Ukraine as the best money we've ever spent. Senator Graham appears to have made the remarks at different times in the conversation, but the short video by Ukraine's presidential office put them next to each other. It caused outrage in Russia. The Russian Interior Ministry then issued the arrest warrant. I'm Rita Foley.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America, Washington, DC.